Covering the Western Hockey League from south of the border, this is the U.S. Division Podcast.
Welcome to episode 11 of the U.S. Division Podcast. I'm Scott Sepich. Tonight we have Andy Ide of 710sports.com. We're going to talk Thunderbirds Rockets round two playoff series. Andy and I get into quite a bit concerning the T-Birds outlook for this series, how last year's series might play into this. Also talk about things like attendance, and I'll go off on a few tangents of our own, but it was a pretty good conversation with Andy. Tomorrow, going to be doing a podcast with Portland Winterhawks blogger Chad Balcom, and we're going to talk about that Winterhawks Royals series, which starts on Friday. So going to have two good podcasts for you this week, going in-depth into these series. So looking forward to these, and let's get right to things with Andy now. All right, now we have the probably the closest thing we had to a regular guest here on the podcast. For a third time, Andy Ide joins me. Andy, welcome back.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
So things are good right now in Seattle Thunderbirds land. First playoff win in 6 years, right?
That's right, 2008, I think, was the last one, when they ironically beat Kelowna in seven games.
Right, 2008. So I guess just sort of kind of encapsulate the mood right now around the team and how beating the Silvertips here sort of, I guess, validates a little bit the path that they've been on the last couple of years to rebuilding this thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's I think they're pretty happy with where they are right now and where they're going. Steve Konowalczuk is in his third year, and he very subtly and not so subtly has been getting rid of players that I don't think fit into his system or the style of play he wanted to do to use here in Seattle. And you look at some of the moves they made, some of the players they brought in, guys like Jakubowski and McKechnie and Mug Maxwell, those are kind of Steve Konowalczuk players, guys who play 200-foot games. So 200-foot games. So he's kind of been slowly doing that. And I think right now this is kind of the high point or the culmination of the transformation from what he inherited to what he wants it to be. And then so this is the most success they've had, the most success he's had in his third year here. And I think they're very excited to get through the first round of playoffs. Their goals before the season was to get home ice advantage, which they did. And after that, they didn't really set how far they wanted to go in the playoffs. They just wanted to make a quote-unquote run in the playoffs. So this probably counts as that, getting into the second round. So I would say they're feeling pretty good that they met all their preseason goals that they wanted to achieve.
Yeah, and then the last series, I think a lot of people, I think most people probably thought Everett would win that series, especially based on how the end of the season went for both teams. And then the T-Birds ended up winning it in five games. I don't know that anybody saw that coming, even if people that thought Seattle would win it. So what were your impressions, and was it as lopsided as a five-game series might appear?
No, it was actually a closer series than the four games to one tally would indicate. They won the first game 2-1. There was an overtime, a 4-3 overtime win in there, and then a 3-1 win. The games were all pretty close. Even game five, the one that Seattle wrapped it up in, was 1-0 after two periods. And Seattle didn't score until about 4 minutes left in the second period. And then they kind of blew the doors open in the third period to make it 5-0. But so Everett hung tight with them. I think, I agree with you, because Seattle was kind of stumbling down the stretch, and Everett obviously was on fire. If you look at the last game of the season, Seattle went to Tri-City, and after getting hammered in Portland the night before, 7-0, they go to Tri-City for their third and three nights, last game of the year. They needed the win, and then they needed to hope that Everett wouldn't win to get fourth. And Seattle beat Tri-City 6-1, which on the surface doesn't seem like much, because Tri-City was resting Comrie. I think they had some other players out. But it almost like that game kind of got Seattle back into their groove. It was one of their better games they played in a long time. And so you kind of thought, wow, they really played well, but did that mean much? But I think it might have got kind of, given them some confidence back, because they played really well against Everett. Probably those five games, or I guess the four they won, were better than any games they played, against Everett all year, I would say, all the 10 that they played.
I mean, you saw Everett quite a bit this year, too. What happened with them? Was it Were they really just a team that relied too much on Winquist to propel them?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're also not a very physical team. And so Seattle wore them down. You know, Seattle is a very physical team. They will hit you, and that's the kind of their MO. And they're kind of built for the playoff series. And I think as the series wore on, Everett wore down. And then Everett really is maybe, I wouldn't quite want to say a one-line team, but they really do rely on Winquist. And the Scott Enser line for Seattle, which is Enser, Jakubowski, and McKechnie, really shut him down. And they also shut down Carr and Nick Galishin, who are their other big scorers. You know, outside of game four where Nick Galishin or where Carr went off for the hat trick, Carr didn't score in any of the other games. Winquist had a goal in that same game, but he didn't do anything. And in game five, Winquist was pretty invisible. So I think the keys were that they were able to shut down Everett's offense, and then they just wore them down physically.
Yeah. And won the goaltending battle, too, that Seattle did.
Yes.
You know, I mean, Cozen, I think, I mean, I would expect you would say that he's been better than you guys probably would have expected him to be based on how he performed in Kamloops.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a pleasant surprise. I think everybody thought he was a pretty good goaltender, but it was hard to say with the team in front of him in Kamloops. I know Seattle liked him because I think he had beaten them the year before. Like he had a couple starts against Seattle the year before when Chevalier was still there, and he beat Seattle. So I think that may have got their attention a little bit. But you know, now playing in front of a team that has a better defense and more experienced defense, he really has shown well for them, and you know, he looks like the kind of goalie that can steal a game. And you could argue that he might have stole game one against Everett, especially in the second period where Seattle took about five penalties all in a row, and Everett, I think, had 20 shots in that period or something crazy like that. And they only scored one goal on a 5-on-3, and that was a 2-0 game, and then it became 2-1. And so I would argue that he stole game one against Everett. So he has that ability, which Seattle hasn't had. They didn't have last year with Glover. Glover was not the kind of guy who was going to steal a game for you. He was steady and solid, but you couldn't just rely on him to steal you one.
Well, you had a guy that could steal games before playoff. That.
Yeah, they didn't have, but they
didn't have a playoff team, though.
Yeah, exactly. It was all they had.
Yeah, it was an unfortunate timing.
Cozen's an interesting kid. You know, he's, I think he's enjoying playing for a better team. You know, he went from last place to home ice advantage in the first round, like overnight. And, you know, won a bunch of games. He's had four shutouts in the regular season, one in the postseason since coming to Seattle. And he's got a little bit of a swagger, you know. He's not afraid to, you know, push back a little bit when guys are getting in on his face. And every now and then you'll see him kind of look like he's jawing with people. And that's something they haven't had in goal in a couple of years either. So, yeah, he was great against Everett, you know, all but the one game where the whole team kind of stunk in game four. But so he's a key going forward. I mean, if he could steal a game against Kelowna, especially up there, that would be huge for the series.
Cozen drew some attention for making a comment about expecting to be in the Memorial Cup, and which I didn't have a problem with, because I think as a player, I mean, if you don't think that you have the capability of winning, then why play? But what were your impressions of reading that when he said that?
I was actually standing there when he said it. I think he got kind of wrapped up in a moment there. It was after, I think, maybe his second consecutive shutout. I don't know that he was really saying, yeah, we're going to win the Memorial Cup. I think really what he was trying to say is that he was excited the team he was on, and that they thought they could, you know, they could do some damage in the playoffs. It's almost like he said it and kind of had this awkward pause.
Right.
I just say Memorial Cup?
But I think
it kind of came out.
But I think you kind of understand what he was trying to say there. Like, he probably wasn't, you know, like,
yeah.
I understand what you're saying, because it's, like, some people just took that to mean, like, you know, it's Memorial Cup or bust for the T-Birds in his eyes, and I don't think that was the case. This seemed like he was probably excited to be on a decent team finally after having to struggle through Kamloops for half the season.
Exactly. I mean, he went from a team that had, I think at the time, 7 or 8 wins to one that was, you know, over 30 like overnight, and that was early on in his time there when he said that. I just took it as like, hey, we have a good team here, and I think Memorial Cup just came out without him really thinking about what he was saying. So yeah, there was an awkward pause there where I think he kind of said, wait, did I just say Memorial Cup? I don't know if I meant that, but that's how it came out. But yeah, I didn't think anything of that. I didn't think he was making any kind of bold predictions or anything like that.
And I forget what was it? Whose story did that with that quote in? Was that in one of your stories, or was that?
No, I forget. It was one of the other outlets here. I forget who had done that one.
Was it like a Jim Riley story or something? I'm trying to remember.
It might have been. Yeah, it might have been that, or it might have been the 1090 website, the flagship station that carries the radio. They do a little bit. They do some stories as well. I think that might have been where it was.
Yeah, it didn't seem like something you would have printed without some context. So.
Yeah, no, and I left it alone because I was standing there and I could kind of see what he was saying, and I didn't think it was worth.
Yeah, well, it's a.
I didn't think he was saying what he was really saying.
Right, it's a good soundbite, but it's not necessarily. It's a little misleading, probably, from what he meant.
Yeah.
But, well, I mean, I guess moving on to this series with Kelowna, I suppose that. More than most 4-versus-1 matchups, there's a lot of intrigue here just because of these teams playing last year and what happened in that series and the fact that the T-Birds are certainly a better team this year than they were last year in general. How much does that series last year playing into the minds of the guys who played in it in terms of giving them confidence that they can actually hang with Kelowna?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I actually talked to both coaches yesterday for stories I'm working on. And both kind of downplayed that. You know, Seattle has a few players that played in that, but they've also turned their roster over pretty dramatically. You know, you have guys like Cozen who wasn't here. You have all the Lethbridge guys who weren't here,
yeah.
The 4 or 5, however many it is from Lethbridge who weren't here. Even somebody like Brandon Truk was injured and didn't play in that series. So I'm not sure how much it really is going to affect anything, you know. Some of the, and then you also have Barzell and Gropp who are rookies, and Bear who's a rookie, he wasn't here. So I don't know that. I think the fans are all excited about it. I'm not sure how it's really affecting the players. What I think gives the T-Birds a little bit of confidence is how they played against Kelowna this regular season. They were 2-1-0-1. Both teams were 2-1-0-1 against each other.
Right.
With the shootouts and stuff, they had equal records against each other. But, you know, they won a game in a shootout up there at Prospera Place, which is a hard place to win. I think Kelowna only lost 4 regulation time games there. And, you know, they beat them once here pretty handily. They got beat pretty handily up in Kelowna, and then they lost a shootout at home. So I think the fact that they played them even this year is what's giving them a lot of confidence.
And I assume that the game plan is going to be similar to what they did against Everett, try to wear them down and try to get it into a long series and just kind of win the battle of wills and attrition.
Yep, and that's almost exactly what Steve Konowalczyk told me. He said something to the effect of he'd love to have it go 7 games and wear them down. I think they did that a little bit last year. I think that they're more physical than Kelowna is as well. I think they're going to, the same game plan, they're going to try and get the puck deep and then bang on their D-men. To try and create turnovers and generate some offense. And last year really did wear down Kelowna. You know, they started getting players, started losing players to injury late in the series. And then you look at what Kelowna did in the second round, where I believe they got swept by Kamloops.
Yeah, that,
you know,
wasn't,
I
even
wonder
a
how much of that.
That wasn't even a competitive.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that was.
That
yeah, no, and I wonder how much of that was that just Seattle had kind of taken a lot of steam out of them. And Seattle really did bang them pretty good in that series. And that's what they did to Everett. That's what they like to do to everybody. They play physical. They play right up to the edge sometimes. Sometimes that can bite them, you know, when they start taking a lot of penalties because of it. But if they stick to it and they're smart about it, like they were for most of the time during the Everett series, you know, that can be pretty effective, and they can really wear a team down.
Yeah, and where, and I don't know if in your discussions with Konowalczyk, if you talked about this, but what... I mean, where's the line with them in terms of where the physicality starts becoming a detriment to them, and how are they, I guess, what does he do to make sure that they know where that line is and they don't cross it too often?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't ask him that specifically this time, but that's something that's come up over the year during the season, you know, and he'll always say, you know, we want to be physical, but we have to be smart about it. And you know, these are young kids, and sometimes emotions can get out of hand. And that's kind of something. They have a lot of players who sometimes lose track of that, you know. And the only time I really saw it in this series, although they did take a lot of penalties, but the game up at Everett that they lost, game 4, you really saw them taking some bad penalties, you know, just dumb penalties that you scratch your head and thought, wow, what was the point of that? You know, did you really need to make that hit there? So they can do that. And when that happens, the floodgates kind of open. You know, they've had some ugly losses this year that really have inflated their goals allowed number. I think they're a better defensive team than the stats show. But when they do kind of get in that mode where they're running around or they let their emotions get the best of them and kind of lose focus, then boy, the floodgates open and they give up 7, 8, 9, 10 goals, which has happened 3 or 4 times. And so I don't know, you know, it's tough. I don't know what he does exactly or what he says to them. I think just kind of trying to reiterate that, hey, it's okay to be physical, but you got to be smart about it. You got to, you know, not have it the hit be late, not get up high on people, and just, you know, it's okay to just hit people clean and hard. And they do that for the most part. It's just every now and then that they seem to cross that line too much.
Yeah, and you also have a team captain up there who is always pushing that line too. And I guess you don't see a lot of team captains who are more of the physical agitator types. You're usually more of the calm, measured kind of guy, and Hickman is certainly the kind of the poster child in a lot of ways for the way that you want to see your team play if you're a T-Birds fan, but also can kind of go over that edge a little bit. How much does the team kind of follow his lead?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, his style, because you look at the captain they had the last 2 years, and Luke Lockhart, and they could not be more polar opposite from each other. You know, Lockhart was a very quiet guy on and off the ice and kind of led by example, and then Hickman is not that. He's very vocal. He does play very physical. I think they do follow him a lot, and I think sometimes, you know, he at times has taken bad penalties where you kind of scratch your head and think, wow, you're the captain, that you should have known better than that. Yeah, but I also know that he's playing on a line with Barzal and Gropp, so I think he sees his role oftentimes to kind of protect those guys.
Yeah.
You have a 16-year-old, and then technically in a 16-year-old year, but he's actually 17 in Gropp. And so I think that's where you see a lot of that. You know, he can be really effective though when he's in control, when he's playing hard and physical, and he does create a lot of space on the ice for those guys. But yeah, I think you know, his role should be to kind of set the tone and say, okay, here's how we hit, and here's how we're going to do it.
One thing I've read about and seen that Alex Delnov has kind of has fallen to the fourth line. What's going on with him? Is he just not maybe the right fit there, and they got to play him somewhere? Or is there a motivation factor here? I mean, why isn't he getting more ice time given that he was it the second leading scorer on the team?
He's an interesting. He's up there. I don't know if he's second. I think he might have gotten himself up to second.
Maybe
for
third,
a long time it was true.
Top three anyway.
He's up there with him. He's an interesting character because, boy, he's so skilled. He's got a lot of skill. When you watch him play, you just can see the skill oozing off him. And, yes, he was the second leading scorer. He was only 4 points behind Theodore. And he still plays on the power play. But, yeah, he has been sort of demoted to the fourth line here for almost a month of the season. And I think what gets him in trouble sometimes is he gets out of the game plan and he'll try to do too much on his own. He'll try to stick handle to the neutral zone, and the puck will get turned over, and he'll try and take on 2 or 3 guys all by himself without using his teammates. And I think that frustrates Connor Walchuk. He also, at times, doesn't get back on defense well enough. You know, a perfect example of that was in game 4 up in Everett when they lost 6-1. It was 1-0 in the first period, and Seattle goes on the power play, and I forget who Lidahl, I think it was, got the puck and was going down the ice the other way. And Theodore kind of had Lidahl covered, but Delmoff just let Lindquist walk right by him, didn't hustle back. And it was an easy pass to Lindquist for a shorthanded goal. And that kind of just set the tone for that game. And so sometimes you see plays like that where he just kind of takes I don't know if it's a mental break from coming back and getting back into the play defensively. And so I think that that's happened off and on in his time here. You know, he's been, Connor Walchuk has put him down on the lines. He's sat him, in, you know, for a couple periods in a game. He's been a healthy scratch in his time here. You know, I just don't think, he fits into the style of play that Connor Walchuk wants. But boy, he's a talented player, and you know, he can always be an X factor, you know, because he can score anytime. But he is still getting power play time, so which I find interesting. That's a lot of his goals, I think, come on the power play.
Yeah. So basically, he's being used as a power play guy, and then skating kind of the rare shift otherwise in the 5-on-5.
Yeah, just, you know, I think at least for the beginning of the game, you know, they'll roll four lines, so he'll get pretty steady time out there. But yeah, his wingers, so he's centering a line with Mitch Elliott, who's not an offensive threat by any stretch of the imagination, and Keegan Colasar, who's a 16-year-old rookie who has some potential, but he's still pretty young, you know, and he's still kind of feeling his way. So those aren't really, you know, finishers that he's playing with. I think between the two of them, they had like six goals on the year, you know, between Elliott and Colasar. And so it's an interesting line because you have two kind of grinders, two kind of physical guys, and then Delnoff, who's not that. So, but they've been okay in the playoffs, at least Elliott and Colasar. I know Delnoff had some weird games, but in game five, I think Elliott scored a goal and Delnoff scored a goal. So that line came up big in the third period there. But he'll also get some shifts, you know, after penalty kill. Sometimes you'll see him out there with Lutzberg and somebody else who wasn't on the PK. So he's kind of used a little in a little versatile way, but yeah, he's pretty much anchored on that fourth line.
So heading into the series, how important is you talked about how this team has a tendency every once in a while to get blown out, and how important is it in game one to not have that happen? Is that something that if they do get beat, you know, 7-1, 8-1, something like that out of the gate, is that something they can recover from? How big is it to at least play a close game, even if they were to lose that first game?
Yeah, I think it's always important to me. You never want to see that happen. But Seattle, they have shown that they can erase those things, which is kind of surprising. You know, they had a lot of those games this year. They had a lot of them after Christmas when they had injuries. That was more to injuries than it was to how they were playing. You know, I think they had their two 15-year-old draft picks from last year up for like three or four games, and I think those guys were -8 each when they were up. But they also had some games, specifically in Portland, where they gave up 10 goals, and that, a lot of that had to do with how they were playing. But oftentimes they would come back right after that, and it was almost like that never happened. You know, and a good example of that was Game 4 and Game 5 in this last round. You know, they got to blow the doors blown off them in Everett, you know, 6-1, and it wasn't even that close. And then the next night they go out and play one of the best games they played all year for 60 minutes and pretty much shut Everett down and grinded out a 5-0 win. So, obviously you never want to lose like that, especially game one. But this team has had some weird resiliency where they have short memory. Sometimes also for a while after they win, they have a short memory and come out and not play as hard. So they really are streaky. And sometimes within, you know, a series or within a week. And so it would be bad. It would be kind of, I think it would be unsettling for the team, but I also don't know that it would be the end of the world. You know, I would easily, if they lost 7-1 in game one, it would shock me if they came back and won game two. They've just been that up and down.
Talk about the crowds from last series. I know you had the odd scheduling to get a Tuesday home game there. And I know that certainly from experience down here in Portland, it doesn't, The crowds don't just start showing up overnight when you make your first playoff run. It takes a while to build it up. Is there do you feel a boost coming? Is there more attention being paid to the T-Birds right now? Is there any sort of groundswell from the more casual fans that you expect might start showing up a little bit more?
Well, there's definitely more attention, at least especially from the local media. I know that, you know, The Times had somebody at every game during this playoff series, which they don't normally do. And a lot of the local TV stations were there to get footage and that they would run it on their station. There's players making appearances on a lot of the radio stations and some of the TV stations here. So that's been happening. The crowds, I actually thought the crowds were going to be bigger for this series. you know, it's a weird thing with junior hockey and the playoffs. The playoffs aren't on any schedule that you have. So if you get like your fridge magnet schedule, you know, the playoff games aren't on there. And so if people aren't following the team that intently, they might miss some of that. Seattle had decent crowds for game one and three. Three was obviously their two for Tuesday thing, and it was either close to sold out. I'm not sure if it quite sold out, but it was pretty big. The one they had the smallest one crowd for was game five, and that's because it was not, you didn't even know if it was going to be played until game four was in the books. And so they had a quick turnaround time to try to market that and sell it. And they had just under 4,000, but what was surprising to me was the atmosphere in there. I thought, well, this is going to be dead. But there was really good energy in the building. I don't know if it was because there was some Everett fans there or just it was the playoffs, but it really felt like a much bigger crowd than it was. So it's going to be curious to see what they get here. The first home game, game three, I guess it would be, is on a Tuesday, which is their big two for Tuesday thing. So they'll probably get a big crowd for that. The interesting one will be the next night in game four. Last year against Kelowna, they had that same setup. In game three, they've had a sold out crowd. It was an unbelievable crowd in there. Best crowd I've seen in that building. And you know, they won the game in overtime. The next night, they had probably half the crowd, and it felt like a preseason game from start to finish. There just was no juice in the building. So, that was also a team that won 24 games. So, right. You know, attendance has been up in Kent all year. They've had good crowds throughout the year. So I'm really curious to see what happens next week. It's a second round now. And while it's not a rival in Everett, it's a team in Kelowna that a lot of people know. A lot of people know what happened last year. The first game's on Tuesday, so especially if they win a game up there this weekend, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what kind of support they get. But they have been getting more media attention, which has been interesting to see.
Yeah, like you said, the crowd, only two teams had an attendance increase this year, and those were Seattle and Portland. So to be in that group is pretty good when everybody else has been trending down for the most part in the league.
Yeah, and for Seattle's case, I think it's just they had a year where they won 41 games. They hadn't done that in a long time. And, you know, I think they played more entertaining hockey than they have in a long time. And so I think that brought people out.
I talked to Tyler Hunnix last week, and we talked about whether or not, because I kind of wondered if Kent was embracing the team, you know, as their own, and if the crowds were coming more from that general vicinity, or if it was still maybe the leftovers from when the team moved from playing in Seattle and coming down there. Is there a sense that there's been a shift in the geography of the crowd, of the fans, or is the core pretty much the same core that was with them when they were at Key Arena?
It feels like it's a more of a South End crowd, but it's hard for me to judge that. Sitting in the press box, I've only covered the team for 2 years in Kent, so I mean, he might have had a better feel for that since he's been a long time season ticket holder. But it feels like it's more South End, more Kentburian folks that are going. I think what hurts them for the Seattle crowd sometimes is the traffic. You know, especially on a weeknight game.
On a weeknight, yeah.
Game three, there was a huge 20 car pileup on I-5, and it took me almost 2 hours to get to the game from downtown Seattle. And Nick Patterson, who covers the Silver Tips, it took him almost three to get to the game. And so that's not normal, but there usually is some traffic, you know. So I think it is becoming more. I think it's slowly transitioning into more of a South End crowd, more of a Kent crowd. And I think if they win and people start getting more and more attached, I think that'll slowly start to take over. I still think you have the Seattle contingent, but I think they also lost a lot of North End fans that ever came in. And before the Silvertips were here, they drew a lot of fans from Snohomish County and the Everett area. And so I think that's one of the reasons they wanted to move further south, is to kind of build a new fan base there. But the problem is when they moved down there, they weren't winning for a long time, and it wasn't a very good product. So they're finally starting to turn that around. So I think you'll start to see that transition more.
My knowledge of the city of Kent really comes from the old sketch comedy show Almost Live from up in Seattle. There was a skit called Cops in Kent where they pulled people over, yes, like Well, told a girl that her hair was not teased out far enough, and then there were people from like the city who came down to laugh at the Hicks and things like that. So that's my impression.
Yeah,
that's my only, that was 20 years ago. So I don't know what it's like now.
I think it's changed. I think it's a suburb now. I don't think it's a lot like many other suburbs. But yeah, that was definitely the reputation that it had. I know exactly what you're talking about. It was the whole South End was the butt of many jokes on that show. But I think as the population's grown here in the last 20 years, I think a lot of that's changed, and it's just kind of the same as it is everywhere else. but it's been interesting, you know, that then that area has grown too, where the Silver Center is. Before that was there, you had the King County Courthouse, which is still there. But then across from that, it was just nothing. It was just an empty field. And now there's Kent Station there, which is a strip mall. It's not really a strip mall. It's a nice mall with restaurants and movie theaters and shops. So it's interesting to see how, since Showar Center has come in, how that area has grown. And that Kent Station is always crowded, no matter when you go there. It's always people there doing stuff. So
yeah,
I think they can start to build something. Yeah, they can start to build something there. I think winning is just always the key. You know, people always will support a winner. And they just haven't done that until this year.
That's kind of cool that they have that sort of, you've got the mall, you've got the arena, the restaurants and things like that are right by the arena, which is something we've been lacking in Portland for a long time. There's nothing around the arenas here. So.
Yeah, I know. I've been down there. Yeah, it's Kent Station. I mean, yeah, you'll often see your fans park in the show or parking lot and then walk across the street for dinner, which is pretty convenient. You know, it's just a block away. And you know, if you go to training camp, you'll see me there having lunch a lot. I don't feel like driving back to Seattle when there's downtime, so I'll head over there too. So yeah, it's pretty convenient. It's a nice thing to be able to go before or after a game and then hang out. So yeah, it works out pretty well. And I don't know. I think those two kind of go hand in hand. I don't know that Kent Station would be what it is without the Showar Center. You know. So I just remember being down there before for jury duty years ago and just thinking, wow, there's nothing here. It's like a subway station, a subway sandwich place I can walk to on my jury duty break. And it's surprising me how much that's grown.
Well, and I'm sure that the extended playoff run, I know, helps the city there, because I know that arena had been falling short of the financial projections early on, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the team wasn't making the playoffs and wasn't very good.
Yeah,
wasn't getting people in the seats.
Yeah. And, you know, for a couple of years there, they were not, it's not that they were bad. They just weren't even competitive. You know, I know Connor Walchuk's first year, that team he inherited, they weren't even in most games. You know, most of the games were blowouts, which aren't fun to watch. You know, last year, even though they lost a lot of games, they were in more games. You know, there was a lot of games that came down to one play here or there. Whereas the year before, there were a lot of 5-1, 6-1 kind of scores. And so I think that, you know, if that's like your first or second year in that building, and boy, you watch a lot of that, people aren't going to be entertained by that.
Well, moving on to the other series in the West, what are your impressions of this Victoria-Portland series coming up?
I think it's kind of a fascinating series. I was reading a lot of some stuff today, and I think a lot of people think Victoria is going to give Portland trouble, and I'm not sure why they think that. Cause I don't know. I don't know that I see that being much of a problem for Portland. Victoria's tough. Obviously they play physical. They've got good goaltending, but the level that Portland's playing at right now, I don't know that that's going to be enough to stop them, because, you know, Seattle tries to be physical with Portland, and that, you know, Portland doesn't work. Especially down in Portland. And so they'll have home ice advantage. I'm also curious to see, you know, Victoria's an interesting team to me. I'm curious to see, you know, a lot of people think that the BC division wasn't as strong as the US division. I think you can make that argument when you look at who's at the bottom of that division. So is Victoria as good as their record, playing Prince George and Kamloops as much as they did? Or are they legitimately, you know, a 100 point team that they were? They've got good goaltending, which can always, I guess, make a difference. They play good defense. They're physical. They're big. They don't score a whole lot. And so I think whenever you play Portland, you want to be able to score. Victoria, I'm curious, somebody who covers Seattle, to see how they do that, because Victoria and Seattle are very similar. in a lot of ways with the way they play and the way they're kind of built. And, you know, if you look at their, you know, their goal score, I think they both scored about the same amount of goals on the season. So I think it's going to be an interesting series, but I would be surprised if Victoria won that. I think most people would, but I keep reading that people think Victoria is going to give Portland trouble. I know they Victoria beat Portland a couple times this year, right? If I'm correct,
they actually won three out of the four games, but two of them were in overtime.
I don't know that I buy into that because they beat them three out of four that they're gonna take this series. Spokane had beaten Victoria, I think, three out of four, and Victoria swept them.
Well, I will say that Portland did have the first time they played in November. Portland did have their whole team at the time. Obviously, they didn't have Dumba yet, but they had their whole team at the time, and Victoria won that game 3-2 in overtime. That was in Portland. And then the last time they played was the first day that everybody came back from World Juniors. But I still think Leipzig was out that game. And Portland won that.
Yeah, but he was still suspended.
And that was in Victoria, and Portland won 2-1. So the one thing that the Royals did do is they didn't give up. I think Portland scored 8 total goals on them in 4 games. You could say, part of that is not having guys, but Portland has not had a lot of offensive success, even when the 2 games that they did have a relatively full, if not a totally full lineup. So I think there's some cause for concern.
Yeah, so that must be where some of the angst is coming from Portland fans, I guess.
Yeah.
Just to point Portland, you know, I saw a couple of their games against Vancouver, who I thought might put up a little bit of a better fight. I didn't think they would win, but I thought they might win a game and maybe two. But I would predict that Portland would win this game in 6, which I think, you know, I think they'll have a couple tough games. But I also think that it's really hard to contain Portland right now. You know, you look at how they finished the season. You know, I don't think Victoria played them during that stretch when they kind of really hit their groove.
No, in fact, I think the stretch of Portland's won 32 of 33, and I think the first one of that 33-game stretch was the last time they played Victoria. So,
And Portland and the Victoria haven't played with Dumba, right?
No, those were all before Dumba. Yeah.
It's funny, I did a preview story for the Everett-Seattle game when I talked to Constantine, and I started my story by saying, you know, without question, the hottest team in the WHL is Everett. And I had a Portland fan contact me on Twitter and said, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, well, yeah, but Portland's always good. So I kind of was kind of like not counting them.
It was almost like, oh, yeah.
I was like, yeah, I guess when you win like 28 of your last 29 games, that's probably hotter than the 12 that they had won. But so he had a good point. But I really was just like, I was just kind of dumbfounded how that Portland, that streak was just so out of mind to me because they're just always good that it wasn't as remarkable to me as it probably should be. And so I think in my mind I said, well, Portland may be the better team, but Everett was the hotter team. I don't know if that makes, if that made him feel better or not, but
yeah, well, I see where you're going there, because Everett was playing very well at the end of the season, so they were definitely on a streak. The one thing about the Portland-Victoria series, I think, is that Portland has gotten so much better defensively over the last 2 mm-hmm. months, you know, because early in the year, they really were, they could be beaten 5-4, and recently it's just been they've started to, the goaltending's gotten better, bringing Dumba, the defense has gotten better, the forwards are so good at controlling the puck and keeping it in the attacking mm-hmm. zone that they don't allow much coming back the other way, and a team like Victoria that doesn't generate a whole lot of offense. I just don't know how they're going to score a lot of goals in this series, and
I don't either, and I don't know how much Victoria is going to be able to control the puck either. Like you said, I mean, that's Portland is, as far as flashy as they can be and as for high flying as they can be, what they really are is an unbelievable possession team where they can just throw the puck around and they manage the puck well. You don't see a lot of turnovers from them, and so they just keep it from you. And if you're a team that's already offensively challenged a little bit, that's dangerous because you have to capitalize on every chance you get. And I don't see that happening consistently enough for Victoria to pull that off.
Yeah, and you saw part of that in the Vancouver series where Vancouver got, I think, I think they got 31 total shots in two games here. And
yeah.
And in game two, especially, they really only had, I think we counted, they had maybe three quality scoring chances in the entire game, and one of them was blocked. So, I mean, it was, they just didn't do anything offensively. And that's a team that actually has, you know, some fairly well-regarded offensive players, probably close to on par with what Victoria has. So,
Yeah, I would say so.
It's going to be interesting to see if they can even... the tone will be set, I suppose, Friday for both of these series in terms of... Seattle plays tomorrow, is that right?
Yeah, Seattle plays tomorrow. Thursday and Saturday. I think there's a building issue on Friday. There's something going on.
Yeah, we've got Friday and Saturday in two different arenas, so...
That's always fun.
Which is fun.
Friday, at least we're right next door to each other, though.
Friday night. We call it Parkageddon because the Blazers are playing at the same time, and so that's and a lot of times during the regular season when the Blazers and Hawks play the same night, the Hawks crowd isn't huge because the Coliseum games don't usually draw as many and they're usually midweek games. Mm-hmm. But I think there's going to be pretty close to a sold out game Friday here, if not sold out, and 20,000 at the Moda Center, so we might have 30,000 people in one place.
Yeah, and that'll be a nightmare.
We're not exactly equipped to handle that in that specific area. So.
And the games probably start around the same time, I'm imagining.
They both start at 7. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
That's
always interesting. And that game is the Shaw game, right? So if anyone's watching online, they'll get the good feed. And...
Yeah, it is the Shaw series, too, which is interesting. Of course, it's this nice televised broadcast that's not going to be on anywhere in the United States. But although I have heard that there's some potential with Root Sports picking up.
Oh. That'd be good.
Some of the series, maybe replays of the first couple, but there might be slots for future games in the series to actually air them live. But I know that that's what they've negotiated in the past, especially in the finals with getting those on Root Sports and then our Comcast Sports affiliate down here that shows the Trailblazer games, but. Not sure what. Do you guys get that same channel, the Comcast Sports Network?
Yep, up there. We sure do. Yeah.
It shows the Blazers and the Canucks, right?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. They picked up the Memorial Cup last year, and I think the finals, was it Root that did the finals or was it them that did the finals? I remember watching the finals.
They split them, depending on who had the availability.
Yeah, I remember watching
both
on TV. Yeah. Yeah, which I thought was cool because I wanted to watch those, and it was nice to be able to watch them on TV and not over the internet feed.
Yeah, and I thought usually when we do get the Shaw games here, for some reason they never send us the HD feed on TV.
Really?
I watched a game this year that was Portland Kamloops game on a Friday night, and it was like 1985, like watching it on TV. Like they sent the regular feed, and I'm like. It was so nice on the Friday night games that Root produced the ones, those games, because those were in HD, and it was like, I can't believe I'm watching an HD telecast of a WHL hockey game.
What's interesting is I have an Apple TV, so I'll get the game on my iPad when I'm streaming it, and then I'll watch it on AirPlay, so I can watch it on my TV. And the Kootenay, I was watching the game one of the Kootenay Calgary series, which was the Shaw series, and it came in on HD through the feed.
Oh yeah,
it blew my mind. I was like, I can't believe I'm watching HD on the feed on my TV. It was like filled the whole screen, and it was clear, and it was just as good as my NHL Game Center looks on there. It was kind of surprising, kind of shocking. It was nice. It was nice. You were also in an NHL building there. It was in the Saddle Dome, so I don't know if that helped, but...
Yeah, it probably did.
Yeah.
Well, it's always nice to get a better feed, because it's always rolling the dice with our feeds. I remember... I probably haven't talked to you since this, but I remember a game that was here in Portland where the cameraman was not going beyond the blue lines.
Yeah. Remember that? Yeah, it was pretty frustrating.
You and, like, Pogolski and somebody else were just like, Could you please tell the camera guy to follow the puck?
It was bad when there was a couple of odd man rushes both ways, and it's like, I don't know what happened there. I have to listen to the radio guys, because the player went off the screen and the cameraman didn't follow him.
And I couldn't figure out how he didn't know to do, like, I was at that game, and the camera guy's across the ice from where I sit at the Coliseum, so I didn't know who he was, or... I theorized, because that was the night actually that the Trailblazers were playing too, and I said that they probably have the good cameramen over there.
Probably.
Since all the building employees are part of the, work for both arenas, and I think when both teams play, then it's kind of like the leftover employees get the Coliseum.
And, well, the Portland scene is always just vastly different when they play the Moda Center as opposed to the Coliseum.
Yeah, it's always really good at the... They get the... they have the score up there at the Moda Center and the score clock and...
Yeah.
And, good replays and...
Yep.
You've seen the replay screen. Replay. You've seen the replay screen at the Coliseum, so you know that that's thing.
Oh, no, I don't... You can't really see anything on it.
It's...
So that game was pretty comical, because it was hard to follow. I think a bunch of us even tried, tweeting the Winterhawks official Twitter account to say, hey, can somebody do something? I don't know if they checked that or what, but it never seemed to get better. And it was only one direction. If I remember right, he was doing fine on one side of the ice. It was, I forget which side it was, but there was one side where he just wasn't, I don't know if the camera didn't go that far, or he'd never done hockey before, or didn't realize didn't have anybody in the shot, or whether the play wasn't actually in the shot.
Well,
it was kind of a comedy of errors.
I'm told that the camera that they use, so there's a, one of the season ticket holders that I know here, sits right behind where that camera is mounted, at the Coliseum. It says he says literally a camera that's got to be at least 20 years old. Like it's got like a little tiny black and white, monitor screen. So you can see what you're, it's got like a slot for a VHS tape in the side. Like it's,
there was somebody, I think it might've been Tyler Hunnick, who after all the Portland sanctions happened and the fines, whatever the 200 grand or whatever it ended up being, he tweeted out like maybe the WHL should take that money and invest in HD cameras for every team.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty funny. That's not a bad use for that money.
Well,
but apparently they didn't do that.
When you consider how much money they charge to watch games, and how bad the quality often is.
And some of those, I feel that some of those Eastern teams, it's really bad.
Yeah, well, some of those places, it's like, where do you mount a camera? There's only like four rows in the building. I mean, like, you can't.
Yeah. I was watching, what game was it the other night? I think it was one of the Brandon Regina games, I want to say. And I think it was in Brandon where the camera, like, it was under a beam or something on top of the building. And so you could still see the play, but it was half the screen was covered by this beam that was going across the roof of the building. It was kind of distracting. I mean, you could still see the ice, but it was just like half your screen was black from this thing. It had a really funny look to it.
Yeah, well, that's what we get in this league, apparently. So
yeah, that's right. It's better than the old days when you didn't get even that.
Yeah, that's right.
When I first started watching WHL, you didn't see any games that you weren't live at.
Yeah, at least you could watch now, because, I'm like you. Grew up listening on the radio in the road games and never knew what any of those places looked like, so.
That's right. And I don't even think back then, like, you could even, there was a way, before the internet, there was a way to even hear other radio broadcasts. You just had to be whatever team you were following. You just had to follow them.
Yeah, and I remember in playoff time, I remember that when a game would get over here, they would sometimes do the they would patch in, you know, a game from somewhere else. If it was an overtime or something, they'd patch it in, or if it was late in the third and it was close, they would patch in. We'd get like a few minutes of some other city's broadcast. But yeah, but you didn't know the other team's broadcasters. I mean, you didn't know who they were, what it sounded like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only way we ever knew about, especially the Eastern Conference, was you just got the scores at the end of the night on the radio or whatever. This is what happened in Medicine Hat tonight, and we're like, all right, well, who cares?
Yeah. And you would barely know anything about the players. I had a subscription to Hockey News, and they would have a WHL section.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was WHL or CHL. I think they actually had a WHL page. And I remember, you know, being like 17 and just flipping straight to that when I would get my Hockey News, and hoping that, you know, as a young Thunderbirds fan, I was hoping they would mention something about Seattle there. But that's the only way you really learned about other players in the league, because, you know, the paper would just show the score, and not even a box score, just here's the scores. And so you really didn't glean much from that. You know, back then I wouldn't tell you anything about any of those teams that were in the East.
Well, that was a big reason why I really loved... I really loved the one time of year that those teams came to play out here, because they were totally mysteries. I mean, you never knew anything about these teams, and they would show up, and you'd actually get to watch their play, you know, see who's good and see guys that you heard about, and you know, a lot of guys who went on to be pretty good players. You know, when Mike Modano shows up here and plays a game, it's, you know. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal, and
yep. And Trevor London, I remember seeing Modano and Trevor London. I remember seeing those guys come through.
And I've always been a big proponent of, and I know those games don't draw well these days, but I always liked having every team come here through here once. I could always, mm-hmm. I could live with Portland and Tri-Cities playing 9 times instead of 10. You know.
Yeah. Yeah,
or
I
even,
agree.
Or even 11 Portland Seattle games. You know, it's like most of those games are fun and they're good, and but there's every once in a while there's like a Tuesday game with Everett that's kind of like, why is this game happening? Like this.
Yeah. So yeah, 22 of Seattle's 72 games are Portland Everett.
Yeah.
And this year they played Everett. They only played Everett once before Christmas, which is odd. The schedule this year was very strange. So they played Everett 9 times in the second half of the season.
Well, yeah, Everett didn't play Portland until about the same time, too.
Yeah.
Which was, it was strange. Everett was playing everybody else for the first part of the season. I know that... I talked to Frank, who runs the Spokane Chiefs fan page, last week, and he was talking about, you know, if Kootenay were to move, because they play Kootenay 5 times, I think, or 4 times, maybe 5?
Yeah.
A year up there?
And that's big, too, yeah.
And that if they were to move, then all of a sudden, because the Spokane's the one team where all the U.S. teams, I think, only play them 8 times, except for Tri-City plays them maybe 10 times, but would kind of throw a wrinkle into the scheduling again if that series were to get broken up.
Yeah, I wonder what they would do then. If they would, the other U.S. division team would probably pick up personal fan games. Seattle and Spokane always have a weird schedule. I don't know if it's because they're across, they're you know, 5-hour drive away. But they, like this year, they had a week where they played each other 3 times. It was once in Spokane, and they came back here, and they went back to Spokane all within the week. It was like a Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday, Friday thing. That made no sense to me. Like a little mini playoff series.
Portland Everett did that this year, too.
No season.
Portland Everett had 3 games in 5 days this year, in a row. And then there was was it Spokane that had to go to, I believe Spokane played a game in Seattle, and then the next night played in Tri-City, and then the third night played in Everett.
Yes, yeah.
So,
which makes no sense.
Weird quirks. Well, I heard the scheduling was totally different this year, so I guess.
Yeah, it was done by computer, apparently.
I guess we're seeing why that was, well, there were oddities, I suppose, in there. I guess it wasn't a total disaster, but it was just the little things like that that were.
Well, even that were odd. Just like every is before, like, I don't know, four weeks ago, maybe you would there'd be there no Friday or Saturday game. That happened 2 weeks in a row, which is really weird. And then the final 3 weekends were all 3-3s.
Yeah.
It's like, why couldn't they spread that out a little bit? Not have 3 and play a 5 Friday, you know, thing. One of those weekends that you had the Saturday off. So, yeah, that made no sense, too. I think, you know, there's some tired teams there at the end.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll, I don't know, I read some rumblings that there might be some, because I believe Ontario plays 68 games, I think. And mm-hmm. Quebec plays 66, I think. And we play 72. And I heard there might have been some rumblings that maybe they would consider dropping 4 games here. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. Part of me is kind of like, yeah, well, there's a few Tuesday night games that I think that we could all do without. And,
yes.
You know, it wouldn't necessarily be a big deal if they only played 66 or 68 games instead of 72. Mm-hmm. Other than the fact that they've always played 72. It's always been the length of the season, you know, but
yeah,
I don't know if it really matters anymore.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, it doesn't. But you also had that quickie schedule took away the Seattle-Portland New Year's Eve game, which always happened.
Yeah, which...
Yeah, Seattle played Kamloops.
And lost. Big, right? That was kind of a weird game.
Yeah, 7-1. Seattle lost. Seattle had more wins against Kelowna and Portland than they did against Prince George and Kamloops.
Yeah.
Sure. Which is very odd.
I remember that with Seattle and Prince George played like a 9-7 game or something, right?
Yeah, they had a. Was it? It might have been 9-7. Yeah, it was 9-7,
and then the next night was 1-0.
They played a 2-1
or 2-1 or something.
No,
yeah,
it was 2-1 in a shootout. Yeah, the very next night.
That was a.
Yeah, and that was right as they had done their second Eastern swing because they had 2 Eastern swings, and the second one was a disaster because they were so banged up and they got even more injured in that swing. The troop went out again. And that 9-7 game, they were just starting to get some of their players back from some of the tournaments, from the holiday tournaments, so they got Bear and Kolasar back. And they actually started their 16-year-old goalie. They brought him up Sodell, who they like a lot. That was his first WHL game. He gave us 7 goals, but there was no defense played in front of him, so I don't know that you can really blame that on him. And then the next night, Mumau came in and shut him down, and so it was 1-1 going into overtime.
Well, I was always entertained this year watching the Prince George games against Portland because they were more than happy to go skate up and down the ice with Portland. And it wasn't a good plan for them to win, but they actually scored some goals against Portland. They, I think, scored 4 in both of the games up there, but. But lost.
They had some goal scorers this year.
Well, I mean,
Prince George has some guys who can score.
Once they got Fiddler there, and he actually got his head screwed on, like, man, he ended up getting to 50, which is crazy considering how he started out in Moose Jaw.
Yep. Yeah, and sat out a couple weeks too, right? He missed a couple weeks this season.
Yeah,
who else they had? Like Troy Burke.
Yeah, Burke.
Whatever he said. And then
he had a pretty good year.
Pachiro was good, and. Yeah, and Clark Wilson can score. They got some guys who can score.
Yeah, and
they
can't
really stop the puck.
Yeah, I heard that they. I remember the trade time. I was wondering if they would, because Fiddler suddenly had a little bit of value there, and
mm-hmm.
I wondered if they would trade him. But I was told that they actually really wanted to make the playoffs and needed him. To make that run, and then they still came up short again.
Uh-huh.
I feel bad that they don't have much to root for up there. So.
Yeah, although, it's really a shame.
The games were entertaining there, I think. So I mean, they didn't
mm-hmm.
they haven't had a ton of success.
They were, but boy, they just don't draw anybody.
Yeah.
that 9-7 game, you know, watching on the feed, it just looked like there was 100 people there. I'm sure there were more than that, but just looking at it, it looked like there was 100 people there. And I had to laugh at one point, their play-by-play guy, who's pretty good, but he said something like the crowd was getting into a frenzy. And I couldn't help but chuckle because, you know, Seattle was up by 3 goals and they came back and almost tied it. But I thought, well, can a couple hundred people really be a frenzy? I guess they can. It's just a smaller frenzy. And I'm sure there were more people there. Yeah, the camera angle, I'm sure there, you know, doesn't get everybody. But boy, the stands are empty.
Yeah, that's got to be tough as a broadcaster to try to generate enthusiasm.
Yeah, and I would imagine as a player too, you know.
Yeah.
Both visiting and, you know, the home team. You're a visiting team. You go into an empty building. It seems like it could drain your energy a little bit. Like, oh, there's nobody here. I don't have to get that pumped up for this.
All right, well, we've been going an hour now, so that's probably long enough.
Sounds good.
Well, thanks again, as always. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Looking forward to both series out here in the West.
Yeah, and if things go the right way, then we could have a fun Portland-Seattle series.
Yeah, it's certainly in play. It might be certainly not the favorites in Seattle, but I don't...
No.
You know, anything's possible. And
Seattle's got their work set out to make that happen.
So, all right, Andy.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks again to Andy Ide for joining me yet again. You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andy Ide. It's AndyEide. You can also read his T-Birds coverage at 710sports.com. We will see you next time on the podcast.